What's good, everyone? My name is Jacob Moses, community builder at Strongtowns, and welcome to It's the Little Things, a Strongtowns podcast where in each episode, we focus on a different action that you, the concerned citizen, the elected official, the city planner, can take to make your town stronger. This episode's action, using nonprofits to build strong neighborhoods. Take a moment to think about the nonprofits in your own community. I imagine dozens come to mind. And that's a good thing. In order to build strong neighborhoods, our neighborhoods need a mix of investment sources, whether it's from local government, businesses, or nonprofits. Nonprofits bring a unique form of investment to neighborhoods. As residents in the neighborhoods in which they serve, nonprofits can use their unique perspective and skill set to ensure their investments align with the needs of the neighborhood, keeping the existing residents in mind throughout the process. That's why in this episode, we have Thor Erickson on the podcast, longtime leader in the neighborhood and civic nonprofit sector, who's used his unique background in design and philanthropy to help build strong neighborhoods across the world. In this episode, Thor shares how you can use nonprofits to build strong neighborhoods in your own community, including how to find your unique perspective to neighborhood investment, how to partner with your local government, and how to get your community behind your mission. Enjoy. Hey there, Thor. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you doing, Jacob?
I'm doing good. Thank you. How's life in Dallas?
It's pretty good.
Very good. I'm happy to hear it. Well, Thor, so happy to have you on the podcast today. We have a great action to cover together, and that is using nonprofits to build strong neighborhoods. And Thor, I'll tell you what, just having a brief look at your resume, I can sense that, you know, this is really your life's work. So really excited to hear the insights that you have to share with listeners today. To get us started, I'd love to get a background on your work. Thinking back on all these years that you've worked with neighborhood and civic-related nonprofits, how would you summarize the work you've done over the years?
That's a good question. I mean, the work that I've done most of my career to date has always been with residents in a place. Really working to try to understand, like, you know, what their neighborhood or community is all about, and what they want it to be. Acknowledging that places continually change, whether it be cities or rural areas, everything is always changing. And my work has always worked with the people in those places, and you know, making sure that they're part of those developments in a positive way.
And Thor, for listeners who may not be familiar with how nonprofits work, maybe they've just seen the city's most popular ones pop up on their Facebook page, give me some background on how nonprofits approach the places in which they work. Is it kind of this shared philosophy of, hey, we're going to be on the ground understanding our neighborhood struggles? Do they sometimes take a more general approach? Well, they'll just pick a social issue such as maybe housing, access to food, and try to build a nonprofit around that. From your experience, what is the traditional approach that we see nonprofits taking in the neighborhoods in which they work?
I mean, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, a nonprofit is a organization operating model that allows you to receive revenue from both contributed and earned revenue. And so many people will form a nonprofit because they can seek funds to get the work done in different ways. And so, like you hit on, I mean, people have passions about everything from animal rights to affordable housing, to public health and religious institutions and academia, you know, all of which fall under, you know, the nonprofit category. You know, some people choose that they want to, petition elected leaders and they want to lobby. And so they might form a nonprofit that allows them to lobby and affect legislation. So the nonprofit operating model is a very powerful tool to affect change. And that change, you know, is driven by the people. So the other thing about nonprofits is that, you know, they're owned by the people. You have a board that governs them, and the work you're doing is supposed to serve a public purpose. And how people define public purpose can vary, and there can be debates about it. But, you know, there is a general rule, you know, consensus that, you know, you're doing something to affect people's life in a positive, better way. And that's what nonprofits allow us to do.
That's a great point, Thor. And there's this great sense of, you know, accountability as well. I mean, think about Strong Towns. Of course, we make this promise to our members that we're going to do to the best of our ability. We're going to push this movement as broadly as possible via the internet, inspire people to take action where they live. And of course, at the end of the year, we put out an annual report to keep people updated on our work, making sure that we are staying aligned to our mission. And you make a great point as well. That's why we have a board. You know, maybe you have the executive director who has all these great ideas, but you also have this accountability with your fellow board members to ensure, you know, is this really the type of action, the type of approach that our neighborhoods need?
Yeah, it's very true. And, you know, it's helpful when that board is representative of the community, but also has some, you know, folks that, you know, are connected to resources outside of the community that can affect that positive change, you know. And so having a balance there is always very key. And then making sure that nonprofits stay, you know, on their mission is important. But that doesn't mean that, you know, missions can't change as places change. And I think one of the things that we have to continue to acknowledge when we see mass development come in and change a place, you know, but a nonprofit's been working there for years, like, are they still responsive to the current issues? How are they affecting change? How are they part of all of that? You know, and just making sure that nonprofits stay nimble enough to keep up with those times, and, you know, they stay relevant in a place.
So that's a great point, Thor. You know, I imagine, say, for example, I have a housing nonprofit. And of course, in my particular place, there's a housing crisis. In your experience, how important is it that these nonprofits that are tackling social issues have a relationship with the local governments? Like, I imagine if we use housing, for example, say the city is trying to get all these housing grants and say, you know, those HUD dollars dry up. How important is it that these local housing nonprofits have a relationship with local governments? So say they get those funds, they can pass that on to actually a local organization that's doing the work instead of, oh, federal dollars are dried up, no more housing initiatives.
I mean, it's really key. And, you know, there's no like one organization that can do everything alone, whether it be government or, you know, a community development corporation or CHOTO or, you know, a for-profit developer building affordable homes. Like, no one, like, those silos that operate, you know, like, they work for some developments, projects here, a project there. But if we're thinking about neighborhoods and how everything fits together, you need your city planners, and you need your nonprofits that are reaching the people. And, you know, if a nonprofit affordable home developer, you know, is building a product, and if there's some for-profit developers in there as well, you know, you have this idea that not all the housing stock needs to be the same. You have different architects, you have different planners, you have different builders, and you're providing a, you know, options and choices to people. And it's essential that people in that neighborhood are part of those processes so that they can say, this is the character of our neighborhood. This is what the history has been. This is what we really would want from a design aspect. And we know people's lifestyles have changed. You know, families are, you know, different sizes. But not everybody needs a single family home, just like not everybody needs an apartment. But right now in most cities, you can only buy single family homes or condos. You can't buy apartments. You can't buy smaller units. And so the idea that, you know, we have an affordable housing crisis, if you only look at the single family housing market, is very true, because you can't own anything else. And if we could create developments where you could own different styles of housing, I think we could start to, you know, think about affordable housing slightly differently. And it becomes a very localized approach to like that neighborhood and that city and that history of place. And also the current, you know, demand of like who wants to move to that place and how are they integrated to be part of that history. So
you're exactly right. And I really appreciate bringing up the design element, because again, this is a reason why we need, you know, if we're going to create strong towns, we need all these different people with skin in the game. You know, yes, let's encourage our local governments to look at their land use, maybe tweak the zoning a bit to allow more incremental development. Let's not have, you know, 80% of our land dedicated to single family. However, while our local government's working on that, let's see what nonprofits want to get involved in the process. Maybe take a design look and bring their own, I like to say, tilt to the perspective. I want to talk more about the design parts, because what you mentioned was really interesting and probably something that local government officials aren't pondering. Thor, tell us more about your background in design. And when it comes to your work in neighborhoods, why design was really important to the work that you did?
You know, from the time I was a little kid, all I wanted to do was be an architect. And then when I graduated with an architecture degree, I didn't really want to do that anymore. But I had this passion for design and community. And I was fortunate enough to be invited to serve in the United States Peace Corps. And while I was abroad in the Philippines, I was, you know, working with farmers and fishermen, and I was brought to this really amazing place called Batanes in the Philippines to work with their vernacular architecture. Beautiful housing built from like local stone quarries and lime and local grass for the roofing, and you know, they were applying for World Heritage applications and all of this. And so I realized that I could use my design background, but work with community members to achieve something that was, you know, greater than any one person could do collectively coming together. And so I set off on this path to like work at the intersection of where design and planning and community all meet. And, and you know, shortly after my Peace Corps experience, I got my master's in international development from the University of Cincinnati and really refined my planning skills. And from there, I've worked at a couple different, you know, community design centers, one in Pittsburgh and one here in Dallas, and, you know, have been able to practice, you know, working with residents to understand the design process and understand how design can be a very powerful tool. Because after all, I mean, all of our cities are designed. Everything that gets built has been designed. Yes. You know, to leave architects, you know, and designers out of that, because we, you know, might not be able to afford them, is not always true. There's many firms that operate on, you know, reduced rates and pro bono rates. And then there's this, you know, network of community design centers all across the country, which have, you know, a nonprofit operating model that are working on community design, or public interest design is another term used. And, you know, there's ways, most of the, you know, community design centers will work in the most vulnerable places in a city, you know, the places that are, you know, historically disinvested in, you know, that are facing current gentrification and displacement pressures, and are, you know, the neighborhoods that have been historically redlined and have faced racist policies, you know, directly on them. And so community design centers work in these spaces to try to unpack that and undo the racist actions, and try to create, you know, new forms of equity. And so my work, you know, having a design background, but then focusing more as a planner as my practice, has used design as a tool to come in and work with residents, knowing that we're going to get ahead of development or be part of actual development, doing direct design services with residents to see things built. And to me, that's a very powerful sort of niche in that community, you know, development space. And that's what I've been up to.
So Thor, give me a few examples, thinking back in your career, of some design services that you provided to some of these kind of ignored neighborhoods that you're most proud of. Give listeners kind of a mental image of the kind of design services that you envision for these neighborhoods.
Yeah, I mean, most recently here in Dallas, working at Building Community Workshop, you know, the work we did was direct design services of affordable housing, you know, working with a home buyer to design their home. You know, it's really powerful work that BC's doing in Dallas. Some of the work I was doing, this one's really kind of fun. It's called El Sonido del Agua, and it's taking place in the Rio Grande Valley. And it merges, you know, conjunto music with drainage inequity. The Rio Grande Valley is, you know, historically floods every time it rains, and conjunto music is from there. And by working with two different colonias and residents, we hired some local conjunto musicians to teach residents how to write corridos, songs to express their frustrations with the drainage inequities, and then put it to conjunto music. And we put out a CD, and it's a whole campaign using music, historic music that's culturally relevant to the place, to just bring more awareness to what people are going through on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, it's one part, you know, understanding drainage and understanding how to change it. It's one part creative placemaking and, you know, arts and music and, you know, design. So it's just a really cool project. One that, you know, I'm pretty proud of. And then we did cool things in Pittsburgh too, like working, you know, with the councilwoman and the schools that were closing. There's so many schools that close in cities that lost their populations, and these neighborhood anchors and assets just sit vacant for years and deteriorate and, you know, can be repurposed. And so we worked, you know, with a great architecture firm and residents to understand like what residents would want to see them repurposed as. And we put that to economic pro formas and, you know, engineering studies to see where the feasibility lies, and, you know, came up with some cool stuff. And, you know, a couple of those schools have, you know, been transformed and become community anchors once again. And that one took, you know, government and residents and nonprofits and architects and, you know, economic folks all come together to work on something that is very complex that faces many of our, you know, cities. So I don't know, those are just like two very different projects, but, you know, sort of shows the range of types of work that I get into.
Yeah, you're right. It's two different kinds of projects, but you still have this recurring theme of, you know, let's actually be on the ground in these neighborhoods and have raw, honest conversations about where people struggle. You know, and you said the Pittsburgh example, it was schools closing in the Rio Grande Valley. It was drainage and lack of placemaking. Say if we had more of this top-down approach where we're waiting for some outside investor to come and save the day, we wouldn't be having those kinds of conversations, and the outcome would probably most likely do much more harm than good. So going back to why these nonprofits are so essential, and of course we want local government to follow, we want them to take this approach as well of actually interacting with people and making incremental investments. But it's just so encouraging to hear that even the nonprofit can come in, make these ties, and really create investments in the neighborhood that doesn't displace and makes the neighborhood stronger to the process.
Yeah, I think we're seeing more of a focus on this. Like many cities are trying to get ahead of displacement that comes with, you know, redevelopment and direct gentrification. As people, you know, more affluent people want to live in cities again, you know, that comes with a lot of baggage. It comes with, you know, housing stock that is, you know, a higher value than what might currently exist. It comes with a bunch of different types of stores that currently exist. And these developments are happening in, you know, very, very disinvested communities because the land has been cheap and either government or developers have picked up that land and sat on it for a few years and now the time is right. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, that approach can be very dangerous to people and their lives and getting displaced from like their social networks and their, you know, potentially economic networks and all of the things that are going on. And, you know, I think that there's a change that's happening in a lot of places and people are tired of seeing that. They're tired of seeing, you know, people just, you know, kicked while they're down and they want to see people be uplifted and benefit from development. And, you know, there's some cool things that are being tested and tried. One of the things that's going on in Dallas right now are like there's a lot of focus around equity and equitable planning and how do you get folks to benefit from development. The community-driven growth project by Trek is pretty cool. It's working in three different neighborhoods across the city of Dallas, and understanding how a localized approach to, development can benefit residents, and not just in a, well, you're going to get new stores and you're going to get, you know, this and that, but like, how could people get jobs from it? And how could people maybe invest in it? And how can people, get some of the community amenities that would benefit them and not the future residents who might come to place. And so there's a lot to that. And it's a, it's not a new line of work. I mean, I think many planners have been, they call it holistic planning. We've been trying to do this for decades and generations. And, now we call it equitable planning. And so, yeah. we keep the momentum going, and we keep, residents to be part of it, and keep elected officials honest, and all work together. I think that real change can happen, but it will be slow, and it's hard, and it's, in some ways new. And but all of that together, I think, is how we combat the negative aspects of seeing our cities in constant flux of development.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Thor, and you hit the nail on the head earlier. I mean, this is complex. Like, this is a conversation happening in neighborhoods across the country, and there's not going to be a silver bullet solution. However, like Thor has done a great job explaining throughout this episode, if we have creative approaches, if we create partnerships early, and at least just start having these conversations, we can at least try to get some systems and approaches in place that can help mitigate any poor action. Thor, I want to take a quick shift about, what I've been most impressed with what you've described is that from all your work, it's not just maybe hyper-focused on housing or neighborhoods, but there's this design tilt to it. I think about Denton County, population of 900,000 people with 2,100 nonprofits. Like, kid you not, just learned that figure. How important is it for nonprofits to have that tilt? And I don't want to get into if maybe 2,100 is too much or too little. I'm not in that game. I don't know if that's a sign of local government not picking up enough of the pace. I'm uncertain. But as people are considering where the nonprofit fits in providing neighborhood services, how important is it to have that tilt to their approach where, yes, we're approaching affordable housing, but we have a design tilt to it? How important is that tilt, Thor?
Well, I think if you're working in a, if your nonprofit, is affecting development, then you need to have design as part of it, whether as part of the nonprofit that you are working in or partnering with one, designers. I think partnership is always key. There's a lot of, public health agencies that nonprofits that do a lot of work that understand how the built environment affects asthma, heart disease, diabetes, all of these like public health indicators, and how you can trace that back to, indoor living conditions, and how close are you to a park, and how many trees do you have, and looking at some of the studies from like the Trust for Public Land and Texas Trees Foundation that show you how the external, environment, also plays a role in all of that. And so seeing as how you have like a bunch of different focus areas, design is part of a lot of that, because, where you put things matters. But I don't know that, let's just say the 2100, I don't think everybody needs a designer, but everyone should understand how things are built and how things are designed, and, partner [S2] Sure. [S1] With really good organizations that can do that so that everyone can stay mission focused. But at the end of the day, we're creating places that are, beautiful and can be easily maintained by, government and local folks, and all of those things that come with, when you build a nice park, who maintains it, who cleans the bathrooms, yeah. who does this. And, yeah. If the city doesn't have any extra money to take on more of that, then, how do you get that done? And that just adds, more complex things to it. But, I believe that design is a really important lens to approach it, but it's no different than a data-driven lens to me, or human rights sure. lens, or an equitable lens, or cultural lens, And so, having people that think differently and view the world differently through that, I think is how everyone comes together and creates beautiful moments is what it's about.
Thor, final question for you: Strong Towns, of course, our core message is building more resilient places, and I think this applies to nonprofits as well. Whenever those federal dollars dry up, whenever suddenly there's a lot less grants to apply for, how can a nonprofit make itself more resilient to still be able to serve the neighborhoods despite not having perhaps the federal funding they once had access to?
It's going to be really, really tough for a lot of nonprofits. I mean, you know, having an earned revenue line item is key. You know, a lot of housing nonprofits have that because they either are holding their own mortgages or they have rental income. You know, so they have money coming in that's not tied to a grant. You know, there are nonprofits like BC who earned revenue through direct architectural services, you know, which is key. Many nonprofits that rely solely on grants, you know, federal grants, if those programs close, you know, there might be ways that local government can fund it, but it most likely will be at a smaller scale. Or, you know, that's, you know, private philanthropy comes into play, you know, to pick up those pieces. But, yeah. You know, it's a nonprofit game of only focus on like contributions through individual giving or grants is really tough. And having sure. that fee for service line item is really key. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, community development corporations that have like, you know, thrift stores and they have restaurants and they have, you know, different ways where they can bring in revenue to offset the operating costs. And so, you know, as you think about what community development can be, like if you have a business that can be run and you hire local people and that profit can go into the nonprofit to do other things, you know, there's ways around, not around, I mean, there's ways to think about that business and how that business is run. Because at the end of the day, a nonprofit is a business. You just can receive your funding from other places than just earned revenue. And it's important to acknowledge that. And then, you know, the number of nonprofits we have, everyone has passion projects or they, you know, want to do things. And so you just start to think about scale and, you know, wonder how many of those 2,100 are churches, you know, and, you know, who actually is registered and, you know, and it'd be great to see the foundation community come together and, you know, try to get people to work together as much as possible and collaborate and focus. Because, you know, when you have a limited amount of money and you divvy it up by, you know, sprinkle it around, I don't know that you get as much work done as you can, as you can start to focus. But, you know, our issues, our social issues are so, you know, spread right now that, you know, concentrating in just one area leaves out, you know, the other 10 areas that also need assistance. So there's not a one solution approach to that, but just thinking about where dollars come from and being as diverse as possible.
Sure, that makes sense. Diversifying your funding sources, just in case, like you said, if those grant programs close, we still have some extra resources to be able to continue to serve our neighborhoods. That's some great advice, Thor. Well, Thor, this has been an absolute joy. I appreciate sharing your experiences and expertise with us. I know a lot of our listeners run nonprofits. I imagine this was a very informative podcast for them. A lot of great action items that they can take back to their boards and apply to their own communities. If anyone wants to connect with you, learn more about the great work that you're doing, where can people connect with you online?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter, ThorXErickson@gmail.com. Should link me up to any of those sites and be happy to chat and, you know, connect with folks. So thank you for that.
Very good. Absolutely. Well, Thor, thank you. This has been fun. We'll chat very soon.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. If you're enjoying the content, please subscribe to It's the Little Things on iTunes, and we will chat next week. See ya.